in his house. So, welcome to Genesis, I think it's class 11, our continued study of Genesis. It's April 11th, 2018, and here we are. So, we're camping out right around that section, right before Abraham, and we'll get to Abraham tonight. So, we'll unveil some really fun stuff real quick. But first, before we do any of that, let's pray. Heavenly Father, thank you so much for this day, and it's such a beautiful, wonderful day. Thank you for everyone here, bringing them here safely. Please keep them safe. Protect our minds and hearts, and provide your wisdom and your guidance as we study the Word. Open up our hearts to hear what you have to say, and we thank you for this time together as a community and a church and here among friends. We welcome your presence. Thank you, Lord. We pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen. So, boy, do I have something for you guys. As opposed to all the other weeks when it was boring and calm in here.
Yeah, we need to duct tape ourselves to our chair.
Now, this one, it won't require your five-point harness quite yet, but God just keeps blossoming and growing this whole connectivity thing. And I just wish, you know, from the bottom of my heart, I just wish that all the different people throughout the world, you know, that were involved in it could kind of see the interconnections, things that are happening. And they typically don't, because typically you've got a scientist out there digging up an archaeological site, or a historian teaching at a university, and they're not really believers. Or you have believers that are, you know, studying the Bible, but they don't really, you know, go archaeological digs or study that kind of stuff. So there's a big disconnect. But I tell you what, the more that we see it and the more we get into it, it's just mind-boggling, the stuff that's being unveiled. I don't know what'll end up happening, if it'll end up as a book or a movie or what'll happen, but someday this all has to kind of come together somehow. And I've been reaching out to some of those folks, you know, and I don't know, when I write a letter to Dr. So-and-so at so-and-so university, if that person's a believer or not, but I just tell them what's going on and thank them for their hard work. But I'll just give you one new example from this last week or two of study. And this is from the world of PhD level linguistics. Now, we stay in all these other crazy worlds all the time, and we go back and forth. But this is brought to us by our friends in the specialty fields worldwide of ancient languages, linguists. There's a thing called a language isolate. Okay? A language isolate's a rare thing in the world. What it is this it's a language that they can't connect to any other language. So, for instance, English, they can trace back to Middle English and Old English, and they interconnect it to all kinds of European languages and the Romance languages, and you can see the connectivity with German and with Spanish and French, and these languages connect together. You trace that back, and that goes back to an Indo-European proto-language that they all spring out of, and you can trace all these languages. Okay. Every now and then, the linguists get what's called a language isolate, which is where they can't figure out any other connection. There's nothing within the language that appears to connect to any other language. And either that could be around it or from far away. These type of studies have done amazing things. They've discovered, you know, a tribe over here, and it had connections to something way over there in interconnected parts of the world, and something must have happened, and all these wonderful things in the world of linguistics have been uncovered. But these things are relatively rare. And they talk about, oh, this particular language is a language isolate. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't come from anything around it. It doesn't even connect to anything around it. We can't figure out where it came from. It's just crazy. So it's pretty rare, right? So, all from completely different people and different sources, I'll write a couple of these language isolates up on the board for you. And you can go look any of this up you'd like to later to continue your studies. Now there may be, you know, a dozen or two or however many of these language isolates in the world. Here are seven. These are extremely rare. And here are seven of them. Now, for some bizarre reason, these language isolates all come from the same Mesopotamian area. It's weird. It's like maybe something happened where there was a language, and then suddenly a bunch of other languages just instantly appeared out of nowhere.
Tower of Babel.
That is so weird, right? Those guys, unfortunately, have no idea. They're like, this is crazy. It's almost like a bunch of languages came out of nowhere one day. This is real. Okay? This is real. I'm not working from some kind of bizarre book written by some weird late night evangelist guy. Okay? I'm talking about the top PhD level linguists at the top universities in the world are all in agreement of the rarity of language isolates. And the people that study these regions, and these are all different people studying different languages, and they've discovered these language isolates that can't be connected to anything else, and it's real. And if you pull up a map, you're going to see Tigris-Euphrates River, the approximate location of the Tower of Babel, and pow, 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 all these languages. And it will literally, in one moment, just change your whole life. Now, we believe the Bible anyway. The Bible could say some crazy thing that no one could support or whatever, and we would believe it because it's the Bible, and we know the Bible to be true. We have faith, okay? What I'm trying to tell you is, over and over again, God is providing these things that are not faith-based, that are supporting faith. It is over and over and over again for the last 6 months at least. And it's mind-boggling. I took linguistics in college. Okay, I've taken a little bit of everything. Hopefully that's God and that's helping all this. But I knew the concept, but I didn't realize that there were so many in such a tiny area.
Right in the Tower.
Yeah. And I read this article from this expert, you know, Dr. So-and-so, writing about Sumerian and how crazy it is it came out of nowhere. And then this person who's studying Kassite and can't believe how crazy that is. And the Elamites and the Elam history is pretty extensive. I've been talking to a lady at Oxford who is a master of cuneiform, the first written language, and she teaches Akkadian. Remember we talked about Akkad? We've been talking about Akkad for a couple months now. That's that northern kingdom that took over. And that she's an expert in Proto-Elamite, which is this early Elamite language, and they're writing all this stuff about how it's a language isolate. It doesn't seem to come from the area of India or from the area of China or from the north. It just appears out of nowhere. If there was one language or two languages like that, that would be one thing. But seven? You might go through 500 languages and not have a single language isolate. And there's like seven in this one small little area. Now, we don't know exactly where the Tower of Babel might have been. We don't know exactly what might have happened. We read that story last class, and it's kind of put in a weird place in the Bible, in the story of Shem, and kind of hard to figure out. It seems out of place. We don't really know exactly. There's a lot of details in it. who was in charge or whatever. There's not a lot of detail in that story. And I don't know. I don't have a definitive answers for everything. I mean, obviously, that's why we study. But this is just awesome and crazy that the world of linguistics is full of this discussion, and nobody, I mean nobody, would ever dare mention the Tower of Babel. Because that would make you a quack, right? Even though that you could study seven languages that appear out of nowhere magically, and you're not a quack. This is bizarre to me. You can explain to people that at the beginning of time, there was this big bang, and everything came out of nothing. And as long as you don't say God, you don't sound crazy. But you just said there was a big bang, and everything came out of nothing. I don't understand why that's crazier than one thing's crazier than the other. You know what I mean? So to me, this just continues. And I had this great discussion. So I'm doing. I find this thing, and this is a, like I said, we could literally just stay here forever and just keep talking because it's nuts. But I found this thing. Okay, this is kind of a weird story, but I'm working on Sargon. I'm working on the Akkadian Empire. So just to kind of bring it up to speed, the world's first sort of empire kingdom in the world happens to be a thing called the Akkadian Empire. Give or take, there's argument, okay? But give or take, the first one ever. And this is also the first of the long line of Semitic languages. So what they've said is that in this region that we've been discussing in Genesis, all these things develop in this one little region. Now we read all these things that seem so big and crazy in Genesis, like the first whatever, and this guy did this, and there was a flood, and all this stuff. And then you go back to science, and you expect them to have a complete argument. Oh no, there was like a whole different thing over here. And they don't. But they don't ever reference this. But yet they say, okay, for some reason, the world's very first languages are in this area. For some reason, the first writing in the whole world was in this area, cuneiform, in Sumeria. For some reason, we have all these language isolates in one area. They just appeared out of nowhere. We don't know where. Maybe it was aliens. Okay? For some reason, the world's first city was built here. The world's first city, for some reason, was built here, and a bunch more of them. For some reason, the world's first empires and kingdoms were here. But nobody goes, you know, nobody at the PhD convention until I get there, okay? Nobody at the PhD convention goes, because I can get in now, I got my card, okay? And I'm going straight there, Philadelphia, wherever it is, I'm going to be like, excuse me, isn't this all explained in one little book that we all have access to for free in our hotel room? Isn't this already explained? But I love this, man. I just can't even explain how much I love this. So I'm looking for information about Sargon. Now, here's why I'm looking for information about Sargon. Buckle. Now, this one, okay, go ahead. Buckle up. Duct tape yourself to the seat. Okay. I'm almost positive Sargon is Nimrod. Okay. No one else on earth has ever said that. They will revoke my PhD card. Okay, don't tell anybody. But I'm almost positive Sargon is Nimrod. Now, Sargon is the founding father of the Akkadian Empire, which united Sumeria and Akkad, which is the Mesopotamian Delta between those rivers, the place where Eden was, the place where everything is, okay? We've been dealing with this now for 11 classes. The place where all this stuff is, the very first kingdom in the world, is called the Akkadian Empire, the Akkadian Kingdom. The person who founds it is named Sargon. Now, Sargon the First, Sargon the Second's in the Bible. He's mentioned by name in the Bible, by the way, Sargon. So there's a complete connection there. But I'm studying this because I'm like, okay, this is a flood time frame. And these guys are related to the Bible in some way. I don't know if they are descendants of X, Y, or Z. I don't know if they are the Nephilim descendants or if they come out of Eden somehow. I'm not 100% clear. I'm working on it. But Sargon is described as this really great man, and he puts this stuff together. And he's got, and I'm working on Sargon and his son and grandson, and they have this little 300-year-long empire right around the time of all this kind of stuff. And it's important for tonight's class because we got another answer from this. And that's a guy from Cornell who has figured out using dendritic. Anyway, never mind. I'll get back to that in a minute. Okay, the point is that the description of what Sargon was in charge of, how he united these areas, is the same description of how what Nimrod was in charge of. Okay? He was called this great man. He united these areas of Samaria and Akkad. And Akkad, which we've been talking about, A-K-K-A-D, that place we've been talking about in this class, is mentioned in the Bible under Nimrod. Okay, so most people have put, biblical scholars traditionally have put Nimrod as the one in charge of the Tower of Babel. We don't have biblical, direct biblical evidence of that, but it would be in his region. It would be in the time frame, and it would be in the discussion of Nimrod. Well, all that stuff falls under the realm of Sargon. Now, Nimrod is related. Give us the genealogy for a second, Andy, of Nimrod.
I have to look it up.
Because his father is what, Kish, right? Cush.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a Ham child, right?
Yep.
So Ham's his grandfather, okay? So making Noah his great-grandfather, right?
Yeah.
Noah, Ham, Cush, which is Kish. So Sargon is described as coming out, and in the non-biblical record, the Akkadian kings list, Sargon is described as emerging from Kish, which is Cush. Kish and Cush are the same deal, okay? So there's a connection there. And he's very large. And this is the thing that Andy's was talking about, trying to trace this Nephilim, Rephaim lineage from pre-Noah. We know that some of these giants survived because of things like Goliath. So we were having discussion if they tread water really well, or they had another boat, or, and this is a common idea, which I really like because it sticks so tight to the biblical text. We don't know about the three sons of Noah's wives. We're not given any history of those wives. So it's quite possible that one of those wives, or more, had blood relations to this line. Okay? If that's true, you know, that maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's one of those recessive genes, like red hair or albinism or whatever, and maybe like Ham's wife was normal size. And then one of their kids was, I don't know. Okay, I don't know how this would work. But some way that some of this survived. We already went through Og's bed. Remember, we had all the measurements of Og's bed. Og was a king, and he was one of those descendants of the Rephaim or the Nephilim. So he had this like 15-foot long bed. He was obviously a giant. We've got evidence of, you know, obviously David killed Goliath, who was described as a giant. We got his measurements. He's big, real big, not Shaquille O'Neal big, much bigger than that. And he has brothers the same size, you know. So we have all this evidence that we've been working on. And the idea that they survived. Now, the reason I mention that is because if Nimrod is from the line of Ham, and it's Ham's wife who is the questionable, possible, you know, part Rephaim or whatever you want to call it. And this is how we get that problem. Well, Nimrod is related, okay? And so the description of Nimrod as a great man might be the same thing as the description right before the flood, where these people were called the great men of old, these descendants of Nephilim. They were giants of stature as well as giants of prowess and power. Why is that important? Okay, coming back around, I find a thing called a stele. Now, we've talked about this before, okay? This word is stele. And what it is it's a stone tablet, like a monolithic thing that the kings would put up, and they put them up like they're like bragging rights. Okay, they would put this Stela up, and it would be proving their prowess. They would talk about their wars and stuff and their victories. The reason we discussed these before is because we were talking about the bunch of different Bible history things, but one of the things we were talking about was that time when, and this is a completely different time frame, many, many years later, okay? But we talked about when the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, had invaded and taken all the cities of the Israelite Empire and had laid siege to Jerusalem. And you remember this from the Bible, how an angel came and killed 185,000 Assyrian soldiers in one night. Right? We talk about that a lot. Look that up in Kings if you want to check it out. It's amazing. But I wanted to see if Sennacherib, who's really famous, he really was one of the more powerful Assyrian kings, if he had written this down and what he had to say about the siege of Jerusalem. Because if the Bible's true, which we're assuming, obviously, then there would be some kind of weird hiccup in his record, right? Because he didn't take over Jerusalem. He took over every other city. The Bible says he took over all the other cities, laid siege to Jerusalem, and then the king took the letter in front of God and said, "Hey, you're gonna have to solve this because I can't solve this." And so God solved it, right? So you get there and you go back to Sennacherib's steles, and there's three of them. He put them everywhere. He conquered everything. He was a total big bad boy. Okay, he took it all. And except when he gets to Jerusalem. And of course, he's not going to record. And then an angel killed 185,000 troops and we ran. But he'll never put a defeat down on a stele. A stele is advertisement. But he does put, "We laid siege to Jerusalem and then we came home. And then we went home. We never took it, we went home." Which is huge. Because that's a cross-reference of a completely non-biblical source that's completely confirming in the same time frame. So the times are all lining up. So the time of Sargon and the establishment of the Akkadian Empire is matching the time of Nimrod, and what they're ruling is matching, the area that they're ruling is matching, and the area that they come out of or who their father is matching. Okay. So I'm studying that, and we think this might be the line of the giants, right? Or something like that. So I'm looking into this. And you're not even going to believe it. I'm just going to tell you because it's totally insane. But here it is. There's not a whole lot of stuff on Sargon, okay? But he has a grandson named Naram-Sin. And Naram-Sin is the fourth emperor of Akkadia, of the Akkad people. He's his grandson. Okay, he had two older sons. He had an older son, a younger son rule, and then his father, and then Naram-Sin. Okay, Naram-Sin is the second most powerful. He's described as being like the second coming of Sargon, basically. Sargon the Great was the establisher of the empire, the one who united the whole Mesopotamian area for the first time ever. And Naram-Sin actually did the same thing and spread it out bigger. He is considered even a bigger, more powerful, or as big and powerful as Sargon. And he has a stele that still exists. And I would like you to go at some point when you're playing on the computer, okay? Instead of watching a Seinfeld rerun, go put in the computer Naram-Sin's stele, okay? I'm pretty sure this is not happening in other Bible studies. Okay. Now that's all incredibly insane words that no regular American people would have any idea what any of that meant. But what you're going to see is a picture of his conquering of the people of the Zagros Mountains. The Zagros Mountains are right to the east of what we're talking about. Mesopotamia, right to the east, Zagros Mountains. Go through those to Iran, to India, okay? We talked about that being the area that possibly Cain had gone into near there. Okay, so now this is a lot later than that. But the point is, everything in this picture, in this carving, is completely to scale. All the humans are to scale, all the people fighting, people falling down, everything is to scale. And he is twice as big. And the argument that the scholars have made, that the historians have made about this, is that he's being pictured really large because he's so powerful. And that's a great argument. So what I did was pull every other stele from within 1,000 years on both sides and from 1,000 miles on both sides, because that's what I do in the middle of the night. And every single one of them, all the people, including kings and including gods, okay, are pictured the same size. So you've got the people coming in to give gifts to the king sitting on the throne, and they're all the same size over and over and over and over. I've got them all on my computer now, copies of it all, to make a presentation whenever, wherever, that says, these are the same size. These are the same size. These are the same size. 12 times. This guy is not the same size. It's not impossible that he was indeed a giant. And furthermore, in the picture, when you look it up, in the picture, he's got spears. And he's throwing spears through people and people are dying. The spears are normal size. He's holding like multiple spears that are normal size and killing people that have the spears through them and they're dead. Okay? He's the grandson of the person we think may be tracking the giant genetics. And he's pictured in the picture as a giant. So, this is the kind of stuff we're coming upon. Actual pictures of actual giants, and then every other scholar in the world that's atheist going, well, but yeah, he's just really cool. And I keep shaking my head. So I write them notes. I mean, I don't have anything better to do, right? And so I send them letters. Hey, how about this? Or thank you for studying that or whatever. Here's my favorite one, and then we'll move on, because the point of this discussion was the language isolates. But here's my favorite one. There's this title in Samaria. Now keep in mind, Samaria is what we're dealing with. Akkad, Samaria, unifying it. The time frame in Sumerian. Keep in mind, Sumerian is a language isolate. Okay, so the first language in the world that's written down is a language isolate, by the way. No wonder it's been so hard to figure out cuneiform. But I'm talking to her. She's a master. She actually knows how to speak it. She's speaking the language that Abraham would have spoken. But anyway, she's in Oxford. I'll see her this summer. So, and she'll be like, can you leave me alone now? Yes, ma'am, I can. I want to go back to what I was believing before, please. So anyway, here's my favorite thing from this study recently. Lugal. Okay, NC and Lugal. Just bear with me. I know I'm saying crazy stuff, and it's nowhere in the Timothy Keller manual, but okay. These are Sumerian words. NC is the word for king or leader. Okay? And you can always Google, double check everything I say. I'm not making stuff up. God's giving me stuff right and left like a machine gun. Okay? I'm not making it up. Sumerian symbol, Lugal. And okay, so NC is the title for a king or a leader. And the guys that are studying this region are baffled because sometimes another word is used for the king or leader. And it is Lugal. And it's gonna sound like I'm making this up, and I swear to you I'm not. You can go look it up, because they are confused because they've got two words for kings and leaders. One of them is used most of the time, which is NC, and this is the word for the kings or the leaders. But every now and then they call one of the kings or leaders Lugal. And it seems to be like a title that's like king or leader, but different somehow, but they cannot figure out how to look it up. This is what it says. The exact difference is a subject of much debate. They don't really know what the difference is. Lugal in Sumerian is man big. It means big man. And it seems to mean physically very large man. But of course, They can't say that because that would make them crazy. So they've decided it means like big man on campus, right? Like you're like a stud, you're like the big boy, you know, you're in charge of stuff. But that's NC. NC is a ruler, a king, who's super powerful and runs everything. You don't get more powerful than the guy that runs everything. But some of them are not just NC, some of them are Lugal. So now I have a language, actual word from the language, at the right time, and a picture of a guy twice the size, and still nothing. Crickets in the academic world. Crickets. I'm like, okay. I mean, y'all do what y'all are going to do, but it says big man, and here's a picture of one of the guys described as Lugal who's twice as big. He's stomping on like regular humans. So that's all true. Now they like to use the word great instead of big in some of the scholarly text, so they don't get this question, right? But you can look up Naram Sin Stele, look up Lugal or whatever you want to look up. This is all real. It's all true. And I just stand around like my mouth hanging open, like baffled. But because all this stuff matches. So, what does that have to do with tonight? I'm going to show you how insanely tight this timeline is. When you go back and you read the Bible and the Bible has some random story about Abraham doing whatever, it seems disconnected and weird. There's a kid born over here, somebody's the son of somebody. Everything seems just kind of weird, right? Or you go and you study the ancient Mesopotamian region and study the history. It doesn't have the same names. None of it makes any sense. Everything's just weird. But it's not. And the work we're doing is pulling all these things together and cross-referencing them. And all of a sudden, things start to make sense. So I have to give props to Cornell University. There's a professor at Cornell named Sturt Manning. Dr. Manning is a specialist in what's called dendrochronology. So just bear with me for 5 seconds. When you try to study history and you try to date things, you've got a series of problems. First of all, there's this tablet over here, and there's this tablet over there, and they cross-reference, but this part's missing, this part's broken. When you try to use dating methods, when you're this close in time, like within 5,000 years, the dating, using the different elements that degrade, it's very hard to read the proper dates. Now, everybody knows that. It's difficult to do radiocarbon dating, recently, but you can figure stuff out. And so sometimes it's kind of accurate, sometimes it's not. So scientists know they need to take all this stuff and put it together. You got pottery types, you got levels of geology, like where it's found in the ground. You've got stuff like this. Well, this genius, Dr. Manning, is a specialist in dendrochronology. Dendro referring to trees. This is tree rings. Now, all of us are from the mountains of Colorado, so we know a little bit about tree rings. We know that you have rings put down every year, that it grows a certain amount, that those things have variation in them. So it's a really good year, that it grows a little bit more, a little bad year, it grows a little less. And you can track the things that happen through the years by these tree rings, right? Well, what he did, starting with one of the unearthed archaeological sites in Turkey of a ruler's like castle or whatever you want to call it, a place where a ruler lived. This place that he unearthed had 10 beams in the ceiling. And he did a cross cut of the beams. And what happens is, just imagine this. So let's say that we had a beam, okay? And in this beam, there's a tree, right? And it's got all these rings, right? And let's say that this is really wide, and this one's kind of short, and this one's kind of wrong. There's a weird thing here, and this thing. And there's a pattern to that happened as the tree grew, right? Well, we know this tree got cut down relatively right before being used. A year or two, maybe, they dried it. But relatively close to when they put it up, it got cut, right? So you find the place it was cut. you have the timing of this. Now, in the temple, you have stuff that tells you who the leader was. Are you with me? And you have these things with this pattern. Well, now, over here, way over here, in another part of the world, you have another one, and it has a very different pattern. But you notice that down in here, it has a thing that matches that. So now you can go beep, 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 cross-referencing. So this tree is a 72 years older than that tree. And now you got a pattern for this. Now over here there's another one, and you catch the outside of this pattern at the beginning of this one. It's like, okay, so this is 112 year. So now you got 7,500 years of trees or whatever. And because he could find the cross-referencing with the tablets and with the dating based on the radiocarbon and with stuff that was found in the temples from timing, he was able to confirm the middle chronology that it had to be right. Now, there's four or five chronologies that scientists work from. They're trying to figure out what was when, which can be hard, right, Andy? Okay, to figure out what was when. So they have these low, high, middle, different chronologies of when time was. But the reason that's important is because he's established that's going to be close to impossible for the middle chronology to not be true. Now, when you go out there in the world and you study this stuff, they'll say the chronology and they'll say low or middle and not, or high chronologies, and you'll know what they're talking about. But what this does is enable us to take that cross-referencing and nail down a piece of it. So we've got the Bible nailed down, and we've got this secondary cross-reference nailed down, and the most effective entire history is going to be Egypt, because they were very good about keeping their chronology, and now we can actually line things up. And that means that we can figure out approximately when all this stuff would have happened. And that brings us to Abraham. Now, once again, you're going to need what's the extra strong duct tape? The one that's fireproof? You're going to need the Gorilla fireproof tape to duct tape you to your seat on this one. But if you were a really open-minded historical scholar and you were reading the part of Genesis that we're in now, you would have several immediate problems. So Abraham is going to come out of Ur of the Chaldeans, okay? He's going to go over to the Holy Land, and then he's going to go down into Egypt. Now, he's going to be described over and over to us as very wealthy and very powerful. And we know from our biblical scholarship, he's one of the most powerful, richest men in the world at the time, okay? And most people leave it at that, and he just wanders around, and nobody asks these questions. For instance, what's going on with the people around him? What's going on with the government systems? What's going on with the empires or whatever? Because it shouldn't be possible for him to do some of the stuff he does, and some of the stuff he does seems very, very weird. For example, he's a giant. Woo, scary. Probably not, but maybe. Okay, but probably not. But here's the thing. Remember when he goes, and we're going to get to this in our textual study. Remember when he goes to Egypt and he's telling his wife to pretend she's a sister, and Pharaoh's going to hook up with his wife, and then he's having this interaction with Pharaoh. Okay, this is ridiculous. This would never happen, right? This doesn't make any sense. The Pharaoh is super powerful. He doesn't need some weird shepherd guy's wife. This doesn't make any sense. Unless it does, okay? But there's very few ways it could ever make sense. Until the cross-referencing. Now that we have established all these cross-references, we find some things out about Abraham and about the time of Abraham. And I mean, brains on walls. Okay? So, the Akkadian kingdom we've been talking about, established by Sargon, doesn't this make sense that this would be a several hundred year long kingdom which would be fading in the time of Abraham if it was from Nimrod, who was the grandson. Get it? This is all going to work. It's really going to blow your face off, but it's all going to work. Okay? We're coming down to Abraham. And Abraham, of course, is a descendant of Noah, okay, through Shem. But he has relatives, including Ham's people, one of which is Nimrod. Nimrod is a grandson of Ham, making him approximately 300 or 400 generations, or whatever you want to call it, before Abraham. You cross-reference all this. Here's what happens. When you put the timeline together, we have an approximate time for Abraham. We have an approximate time for Joseph and Noah, etc. The time in which we have identified Abraham, okay, is right after the fall of the Akkadian Empire. So the Akkadian Empire is developed by Sargon. No one else knows this, okay? This is just you guys. Because no one has the cross-referencing. They just don't. But here it is. The Akkadian Empire's fallen. It fell into disarray. It's about 10 emperors long, okay? Naram-Sin is number 4, okay? It falls apart and the whole area goes into chaos. Well, when Abraham was born and when he was getting raised as a child, he was within the Akkadian Empire, of the Chaldeans. That area is part of Samaria, which was conquered by Akkad, by Sargon, and then again by Naram-Sin. These people, he would have known who they were, okay? Whether he called them Nimrod or not, we don't know, okay? But this is all real. And now he's born in this place, but it falls apart. So when this extremely rich guy with all this stuff, and I mean hundreds, maybe thousands of people, animals, tents, I mean, it was like a moving city, okay? When he starts to move around, there's no one to stop him or tax him or attack him because there's pure chaos in this region. It's also a really good time to leave and go looking for better stuff. Now, we know God has a plan bigger and more important than that, but that's also a timely plan. So we have a non-biblical historical reference point using the city, which they have found Ur. Archaeologists are in it right now in Abraham's hometown. Okay? And he's going to leave. And no one's going to stop him because, first of all, he's really rich and powerful. He probably has a small army, at least some kind of garrison of guys, security guards or whatever. And everyone's in chaos and disarray. So he can pick up and leave if he wants. He can go over to the Holy Land also in chaos and disarray. And then he can go into Egypt. Now, why on earth would he have anything to do with Pharaoh and would Pharaoh talk to him about his wife or anything like that? Because Pharaoh is a god king. Except in a time that we've talked about before called an intermediate period. In the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, and the New Kingdom, all these pharaohs like Ramses and everybody, super powerful pharaohs, Ahmosis the First, which is the father of the people, basically the person who pulled Moses out of the water. But that's okay. Don't worry. Don't try to explain that to anybody, the fact that there's 3 or 4 pharaohs in a row that all have Moses in their name. Don't worry about that. Okay? Just keep rolling. And Moses is the family name of an entire group of pharaohs. When a guy in the Bible is pulled out of the water and raised as a pharaoh's son for 40 years, the exact same time as that, everyone's named Moses. It's real. And no one else, either direction for 3,000 years, is named that. Anyway, going back to when Abraham goes in there, we have what's called the beginning of the first intermediate period. Egypt fell apart. The pharaohs weren't able to have the power. There are multiple pharaohs arguing for power. Everybody's kind of chaotic. And the Bible and the record of the beginning of the first intermediate period, which is completely non-biblical, talk about this horrible time of drought and starvation, right? Remember, that's why Abraham goes into Egypt, right? The whole area is jacked up. Major, major problems, okay? This type of pressure throws Egypt into chaos because they're used to having a regular Nile flooding, plenty of food, everything works all the time. When something bad happens, it throws them into chaos. This happens again with Joseph, remember? Joseph goes in. So how does Joseph, a weird, you know, Israelite, Canaanite kid, right, end up second in command of the Pharaoh? Not possible for Ramses or Amenhotep. But in the second intermediate period, which is when Joseph, and this all fits into the timeline, the second intermediate period, when Joseph's there, he can come in, and if he figures stuff out, there is so much chaos, he becomes that powerful. And we have records of that in Egypt. We have records of a bunch of Canaanite people coming and going from that same time frame in Egypt. But we're going back before that. First intermediate period, the beginning of the first intermediate period, and the world of Abraham. And Abraham's a really powerful, really rich guy with a ton of stuff. He's coming into a place that's chaotic, and the government's broken apart, and everybody's vying for power. Now, a Pharaoh, who might have been on the throne for a year or two and might be thinking he's going to die any minute, might like to talk to Abraham. Because this guy seems to be relatively powerful. He's a foreigner. Maybe he's an ally, right? Maybe that's why he notices his wife. Maybe that's how we get the biblical story, because it all makes sense in the beginning of the first intermediate period. Not when there's a powerful Pharaoh and a powerful Egypt. But that's not what the timeline shows us. The Akkadian Empire falls. Everything falls in disarray. Abraham starts moving. So we're able to actually cross-reference this entire thing. I don't think that's ever been done. Right? And I'm certainly not that smart. That's the Holy Spirit, okay? I just don't think that anybody's ever done all that connecting of the dots. Why would Abraham move around? How could he move around? Why would he talk to the Pharaoh? And all this other question marks that seem so weird as a historian, as an Egyptologist, that story is ridiculous. Unless it's the beginning of the first intermediate period and the Pharaoh's scratching for anything he can get, trying to find allies, trying to find extra money from anywhere to try to solidify his power base. This guy's traveling with like 1,000 people and tents and goats or whatever. Abraham had a lot of stuff, okay? Do we have an estimate of how much stuff? Is any of the study Bibles tell us about approximately what we think Abraham had?
No.
It was a lot of stuff. Abraham was one of the richest people of the time. He would have had a lot of stuff. He would have been very impressive. You got to cross-reference this stuff. It's so much fun. You know, like moving forward through time to say Jesus' life. Think about the Magi coming. And they're coming a few years. He's not a baby anymore. They flee into Egypt. But remember when the Magi come and they get this audience and stuff? If you read that and you think of it as these three guys, like we saw when we were little in the, you know, in the little parking lot where they put the hay down, we saw the three guys and they looked kind of like weirdos with the camels or whatever. But that's not what it was. These guys were princes. They were very powerful. They came with an entire group of people, probably a small army. If these three powerful people are coming to see who they think is the new king of this region, and they're going to travel all the way across the Middle East, they're bringing an army with them. So when they show up, no wonder Herod and everybody else is like, whoa, and they talk. But that makes the Bible story of how that worked make so much more sense. When you realize who the Magi really were, where they were coming from, what they would have had with them. You know, they're carrying gold, frankincense, myrrh. They had security guards, army guys. They had multiple scholars with them. They were going to cross-reference star charts. I mean, they've been talking about this since Daniel. Right? They're related in some form or fashion to Daniel. And that's a whole Babylonian thing. That's a whole other story for a whole other class. But understanding where Daniel went and how that all worked and then what happened there and what Babylon was. And my chart has, you know, I know some such weird stuff now, but I don't know why. Like for instance, the year that Daniel showed up in Babylon is the same year the Hanging Gardens were started that became the world wonder, the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, one of the first wonders of the world. Did they have something to do with that? Did their knowledge from the Holy Land, such a rich green place, did they bring knowledge concerning that? Remember he had a special diet? you know, kind of pseudo-vegetarian kind of a thing. Did he have special knowledge of plants? Do some of these guys know? Because the way we got rice in Louisiana was from Africans. African guys that brought over slaves, they were rice, some of them were rice masters. And they were using a rice strain that had come by way of the Moors all the way from China. There was African rice, but the rice the African guys were planting when the slave ships arrived was Chinese rice in West Africa. Okay? That's because of the Moors' connection all the way through the Middle East, all the way over through India to China. Well, they brought some of those slaves to the South, and some of them were rice masters, and that's how we got rice in Louisiana for our gumbo and our, you know, jambalaya. My point is, were some of these Hebrews, like Daniel or some of his guys, you know, knowledgeable in this? Did they have something to do with the Hanging Gardens of Babylon? No one's ever said that or thought that or written that down. But it just so happens that on the charts, when you cross-reference it all, the establishment of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon are the same year as Daniel arrived. Which is just nuts. So, anyway.